as I say, is on the 9th of June. Today we've got, I think, a very topical subject. The subject is in the form, as we always do, of a question. Is the world economic crisis our biggest security threat? And we have three distinguished panellists. I'm going to ask each of them to speak for about 7 to 8 minutes and then give them a chance, if they want to raise things from each other's remarks, they can do so for a little while, and then, as usual, I will open it up to the floor for people to participate and to ask questions. My panel today, on my immediate right, is a very distinguished visitor to us, Sir David Omond, who is the visiting professor at the War Studies Department at King's College London. He was first UK Security and Intelligence Coordinator as Permanent Secretary in the Cabinet Office, responsible obviously for the professional health of the intelligence community, national counter-terrorism strategy and homeland security. He served in total for 7 years on the JIC, the Joint Intelligence Committee. He was previously Permanent Secretary of the Home Office and Director of GCHQ, and then Deputy Under-Secretary of State for Policy in the Ministry of Defence. So he brings an enormous wealth of experience to the topic that we are discussing today. On his right, we have Gideon Rachman, who is the Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator for the Financial Times. He writes a weekly column on foreign affairs, as well as one of these infernal new ways of communicating, a blog. He's reported over the past year from the US, from China, Afghanistan, Georgia, Pakistan, and the European Union. So you can see that he has a good global reach, and we look forward to hearing what he has to say. Before that, he worked for The Economist for 15 years, so he has a distinguished record as a journalist. And on my left, we have Oliver Cam, who is a leader writer and columnist for The Times. He joined the newspaper last year, where he's written extensively on the financial crisis. He was previously European equity strategist for HSBC Securities, head of strategic research for Commerzbank Securities, and co-founder of a hedge fund, WMG Advisors LLP. So he will bring the financial, the direct financial input to us today. So I'm going to start by asking Sir David Omond if he would speak to us for about 7 to 8 minutes, and then I will ask each of the others in turn. David.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. If I stand up and speak like this, is that audible at the back? All right. Good. Well, and thank you for the introduction. Thank you for inviting me to join the debate. Is the world economic crisis our biggest security threat? Last year, the British government published its national risk register. And the highlight was a chart that showed on the bottom axis the likelihood of various calamities arising, from major air accidents through to terrorist attacks on crowded places. And on the vertical scale, a measure of the impact that these things would have on security, national life. And obviously behind the chart was a great deal of detailed analysis of the risks facing the people of these islands, in terms of the likelihood of something happening, our vulnerability to it, and what indeed would happen if the calamity did occur. The calamity at the top right-hand corner of the published risk register was pandemic flu, not terrorism. And that was the one judged to have that combination of likelihood and impact. Now, it may be that swine flu does not have the characteristics of the modified H5N1 virus that everyone was so frightened about and that finds itself in the top right-hand corner. But my point in introducing this is that there wasn't another entry further out and up to the right of the risk register that said greedy bankers. Why not? Was this a case of category error? Global financial risks were not thought of as being of the same nature as the other kinds of risks that found their way onto the national risk register. I think the answer to that is no. Because if you look at the government's national security strategy that it published more or less at the same time, that security strategy highlighted in strategic terms the importance for our national well-being, of the financial sector, the dangers of global liquidity might pose. It highlighted the importance of strong international financial institutions and all the rest of it. So in strategic terms, all the right sentences were in the national security strategy in relation to the impact that financial instability might have on us. So the powers that be did have strategic notice of this issue. But what seems to have been the case is there was no operationalization of that strategic notice into people doing things, making contingency plans, working out what the policies would be if there was to be a bank failure or whatever. Nor that was there operational alerting that would have highlighted the need to scan for risks, so that, for example, when Bear Stearns ran into trouble, the right alarm bells would have rung, various plans would have swung into place both nationally and internationally. Instead, it all seemed to have been made up on the night. And the reason that I personally ascribe to this is our old friend cognitive dissonance. For the Chancellor, and perhaps even more so for the previous Chancellor and their special advisers, it would have meant accepting that the FSA, the Bank of England, the Treasury, other officials were working hard on contingency plans against the possibility of the complete failure of the major part of the government's economic policy. And that involves holding in your mind two very dissonant thoughts. And it wouldn't be the first time that leaders have unconsciously, or even sometimes consciously, created an environment in which certain thoughts are not to be tolerated. But let's suppose there had been a risk register exercise. Let's suppose that the potential security damage had been evaluated. What would it have shown? Now, we might start with the traditional definition of national security, that is, our ability to defend ourselves as a nation, to defend our territory and our interests overseas from external aggression, and by maintaining effective armed forces, and to protect parliamentary democracy from subversion through having an effective internal security service. I mean, you could make the case, and I won't pursue this here, that greedy MPs have done more to undermine Parliament than any conceivable group of subversives, but I will not pursue that argument. Now, I mean, no doubt that as a result of the financial crisis, there will be extremely severe restrictions on public expenditure under any government after the next election, and our defence forces will be significantly weaker than they would otherwise have been. There may well be cancellation of major programmes. There may well be longer-term damage to our defence industrial base. Given the immediacy of the threat from international terrorism, expenditure on intelligence and security will no doubt be protected as far as it can. But the investment involved in keeping up with the threat, keeping up with technology, is probably going to end up being well below what otherwise it would have been expected to be pre-crash. So in traditional terms, just looking at traditional definitions of security, yes, I think we could say that the global financial crisis is a significant driver. I wouldn't say it's a threat in itself, but it is a driver, creating conditions which actually increase our level of insecurity. But that's probably to take quite a narrow view of national security. The government's own national security strategy takes a wider view, looks at the impact on not just on the security of the state, but on the security of the people in these islands. And that is really a psychological construct. It's our ability to go about our normal business freely and with confidence. And by that measure, the global financial crisis has created a great deal more insecurity in the minds of the public than any conceivable current terrorist group would have done. So if we take on that definition, security as a state of mind, then It's really asking, are the major risks being satisfactorily managed so that people can go about their normal business? And by that measure, as I say, the crisis has, global crisis, has severely affected confidence. If we were to, and I haven't really got time to expand on this, then to look outside the United Kingdom, to look at what the impact of the global crisis will have on other regions of the world in which we have an interest and which could conceivably bear on our security, then again we can see some significant downsides. Indeed, even domestically, just at the time when criminality will be on the increase, which I predict as a result of present circumstances, the ability to invest in countermeasures will be reduced. High levels of unemployment may well create strong feelings of insecurity and could conceivably lead to social unrest. So, it's not hard to conclude, I think, that negligent governance by banks and other financial institutions, fueled by the bonus culture, ends up as a driver of significant insecurity. Now, that said, this is my concluding remarks, I think we should be grateful that we're not actually in a period of traditional security threat. What it does mean, I think, is we're going to have to be more imaginative and inventive in responding to the hazards and threats that we do face, given the limited resources we will have to do that. If you remember, well, some in the room may remember 1883, I don't, but in 1883 the volcano of Krakatoa blew its top and millions of tons of dust and ash blown up into the atmosphere circled the globe and blotted out the sun. Now, we know that eventually the dust and ash falls to Earth and, to extend the analogy, the financial sun will shine again. That's what happens. But the interesting question is what happens to the ecology on the ground during the period when the sun is blotted out? Which species become extinct? Which species struggle to survive? And which species emerge as the sun shines again, stronger, more resilient, better able to take advantage of the opportunities ahead?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Some very challenging thoughts there. Having just come from a press conference of the Intelligence and Security Committee, which was announcing that the terrorist threat was as bad as it's ever been, we maybe have to add that factor in as well. Thank you very much. That was fascinating. I'm now going to call on Gideon Rachman to talk to us for about 7 or 8 minutes.
Thanks very much indeed, and thanks for inviting me. Well, in direct response to the question we were asked, is the global economic crisis the greatest security threat we're facing? I think answering whether it's the greatest threat is clearly a difficult question, but I think partly because the dividing line between threats caused by the economic crisis and threats that existed beforehand may not be as sharp as we think. It's what I think medical companies call pre-existing conditions. You know, you say this thing's happened to me, and they said, oh, you had it before. And you can see, say, with the problem of failed states, which I think is a big security issue, it was there before the economic crisis. But it will be made much harder to deal with because of the economic crisis, because we'll have less resources, there'll be more people suffering from acute poverty in failed states. So the dividing line between, well, what was caused by the crisis and what wasn't is not absolutely clear. That said, I think what I'd like to do is, since we've only got 6 or 7 minutes, is just to list 6 ways in which I think the economic crisis threatens to lead on to a form of global political crisis or could create political disruption around the world and in turn security threats. The first is that rising unemployment and austerity traditionally does lead to social instability, and that can then lead on to political instability. It's a connection that's so well known that it's almost banal. But I think that the interesting thing is it's not automatic. We've actually, although we're now facing a big financial crisis, we've had several around the world in the last decade. Latin America had a lost half decade after a really serious economic crisis. Democracies have been established relatively recently there. And the good news is actually they all survived, more or less, in democratic shape. So it's not inevitable that you have a terrible economic time and democracy suffers, but it can happen, and equally it can happen in the other direction. So that if I was trying to think of examples of where there was regime change caused by economic crisis quite recently, well, Indonesia in 1998, but that was a dictatorship moving towards a democracy. Similarly, Tiananmen Square in 1989 took place against a background of a contracting Chinese economy and upheaval. So it's not just the democracies which could be threatened by social instability caused by economic upheaval. I think the second area I would look at is this whole question of global governance. It's clear that we face now global problems many of which can't be dealt with by national governments efficiently. The global economic crisis was a very sharp reminder of that, and it very swiftly brought into being this new grouping, the G20. I think it was some 6 weeks later they met in Washington. But it's not clear to me that although that the G20 in London did do something to bolster confidence in markets, that ultimately they have the ability to deal with a systemic global banking crisis, because banks are still regulated nationally. And the global economic crisis is just one example of a global issue which we don't really have the structures to deal with. I think the most striking is global warming, where again there's going to be this big conference in Copenhagen. I don't know many people who are confident that actually we will come up with an agreement that will deal with the issue to anybody's satisfaction. And it's not just that these issues aren't dealt with, it's also that the failure to deal with them then creates tensions, because the Americans and the Chinese, for example, there could be really quite serious recriminations, both about global economic management and about global warming. The third issue is the one I just mentioned earlier, failed states. It does become much harder in a period of global economic contraction. I was in Afghanistan earlier this year and talking to some of the American commanders who, like everybody, are trying to sort of figure out what's going on, and their impression was that many of the Taliban forces were not particularly ideological, but there was no work. The Taliban was the major employer. So a lot of what they were trying to do was to provide alternative employment, to get work schemes going, that kind of thing. Just, as one of them put it, to put a shovel in their hands instead of a gun. The trouble is that the economy is in terrible shape in Afghanistan. They've had years of drought, and clearly things are not going to get better because of what's going on now. And just across the border in Pakistan, actually Pakistan has had not a bad run of economic growth, but they're now in big trouble. They've got government deficits, rising debts, power cuts right across the country. So again, you can see a direct connection between economic troubles and the security threats we then face as a result. The fourth threat I would think about is, it's an ugly word, but deglobalization. I think that the whole period of the last 30 years has seen, as we all know, this fantastic growth in foreign trade and foreign investment. And according to traditional liberal theory, if people trade with each other, they're less likely to go to war with each other. Now, of course, we can all think of counterexamples, the First World War and so on. So it's not, again, an automatic connection, but I think that generally, if you do create mutual interests between countries, if you do create trade and investment, that does make conflict less likely. Yet what we're seeing now in the last 6 months has been a very sharp contraction in global trade. Some of that, quite a lot of it, may come back as the economy revives, but I think the other area to watch for is the shrinkage in global financial flows. And that may be more permanent, because as these banks increasingly are bailed out by the state or sort of quasi-nationalized, they then become under pressure to lend at home. And you certainly, if you talk to finance ministers in developing nations, they're very worried by this shrinkage in financial flows to countries like South Africa, developing Asian countries, and that's putting them into big trouble at home domestically. And the other thing to watch out for is the rise in protectionism. We had a big rash of that actually in the sort of from November onwards. I think at the first G20 meeting, they all signed up this declaration saying we will not institute protectionist measures, and then just before the next one in London, the World Bank issued a report showing that in fact 17 of the 20 countries to have signed that declaration had in fact issued protectionist legislation. And there is clearly a connection between protectionism, economic nationalism, and between political nationalism, so that's something to watch. Fifth point, American leadership. This isn't so much a pre-existing condition as a pre-existing debate. Of course, people have been debating how long America can be the global superpower unchallenged for a very long time, since the late 80s at least, since the end of the Cold War, in fact. As yet, I don't think there is much sign of the US drawing in its horns. On the contrary, Obama is a very activist president and is getting involved in everything from, as we saw yesterday, initiating a new Middle East peace process, to revamping strategy in Afghanistan, trying to press the reset button with Russia, you name it. However, it's possible that that is just a phase, and that if Obama's foreign policy runs into trouble, say Afghanistan goes badly, the climate change talks fail, economic pressures mount at home, then I think that you might see an isolationist strain coming back in the US, where they say, well, look, you know, we've tried to be good internationalists, we failed, there's huge economic pressure on us at home, why are we pouring all this money into foreign aid or foreign military ventures? And a question I don't know the answer to, but I think would be really key, is Sir David mentioned we can already see in Britain the pressure on defence budgets caused by huge budget deficits. Will this happen in the US? At the moment, the Americans seem to think that they, you know, it's not a problem, that they can keep this very high level of defence expenditure. They spend more than the next 18 countries combined, I think, on their defence, and that there's no kind of read across from the economic crisis. I genuinely don't know whether that will continue to be the case. There are some people who say, well, look, you know, even at current levels, American defence expenditure is only about 5% of GDP. In times of national crisis, it's gone up to 10%, so if it's important, they can keep spending. There are others who say, you know, if they've got huge mounting, the public debt is doubling, if they've got budget deficits of 12%, eventually that's going to have to feed through to the Pentagon budget, and that will restrict their ability to play the role of global policeman. The last issue I'd like to touch upon, and it may sound a bit abstract, but I think it's very important, is the ideological challenge now to the West. We've just been through a 20-year period in which the West felt very confident about its economic and political ideas, and there was a sort of ideological hegemony, if at the risk of sounding like a Marxist, that was in itself, I think, a source of power. We believed in everything from the triumph of liberal democracy, the end of history thesis, the Washington Consensus on economic reform. But the crisis in the US has damaged the prestige both of the United States and of Western ideas. And I think that too could have long-term security implications, because if liberal ideas are damaged and in retreat, there is a gap there, and illiberal ideas could advance into that gap. I'll stop there for the moment.
Thank you very much indeed. Another set of another set of very interesting points, which I'm sure we'll all want to debate. Just on the question of the US defence budget, I was with an American exorcist secretary from the Pentagon this weekend who told me that for the first time in many years the US Navy is going to drop to below 200 ships. That's quite a good indication of how it's already having an impact. I'm now going to call on Oliver Cam to talk to us again for about 2 minutes.
Thank you, Michael. The answer to the question, is the economic crisis the greatest security threat, is obviously no, of course it isn't. It is not in any sense comparable to existential threats of warfare and weapons of mass destruction. The greatest security threat facing the world, I go back to the last or the only time I've addressed this, had the honour to address this forum, when I discussed the issue of ethics and foreign policy against one of Tony Blair's most cogent critics, Sir Malcolm Rifkin. I believe in foreign policy with an ethical dimension, and I believe in it partly because it understands, in my view, the impetus behind the greatest security threat the world faces, which is the spread of weapons of mass destruction to the very worst of people, those who are the parties of God, who believe they know the mind of God and wish to impose the will of God upon apostates and heretics. That, to me, is the fundamental great existential threat. Very bad people are getting hold of appalling weapons of mass destruction that the Western world faces. The economic crisis is a huge shock, but it is not a security threat, other than in a metaphorical sense. It does, however, have some implications for Western security in this sense. The security of Great Britain is grounded in a collective system of alliances, collective security. And the mainstay of collective security is the NATO alliance, which depends on the United States, the position of the United States, and its guarantee to Western Europe and its other allies of a collective response to security threats. There seems to me, I don't wish to overstate this, but it seems to me beyond argument that the economic crisis is going to affect the role of the United States in the international order and the willingness of the United States to commit to the supranational system of collective security. I don't want to overstate that because the economic crisis is a huge shock to the system, but it is resolvable. It's a huge shock to the system in the sense that all the raw data of industrial production, contraction of trade volumes, falls in asset prices really are comparable to the Great Depression of 1929 to 1933. This is a massive shock. But policy is different now from what it was in the 1930s. A great deal has been learned in the operation of monetary and fiscal policy as opposed to the idée fixe that central banks pursued in the 1930s. The most crushing policy mistake of the 1930s was an almost mystical commitment to a system now long gone, the gold standard, which ensured that central banks, particularly the US Federal Reserve, increased interest rates sharply in the pit of a devastating recession. That sort of policy is not pursued now. Falteringly, with some domestic constraints, massive domestic constraints in the case of the UK, policy has taken the right tinge. Huge monetary stimulus, particularly in the US and the UK, slashing interest rates almost to zero, and because interest rates cannot fall below zero, expanding the money supply through buying up government and corporate assets. A huge fiscal stimulus in the United States. It's not so much a policy option available to the UK because of incontinent and very poor fiscal management since about 2002. And the alarming increase in public debt in the UK, I think, does pose a serious risk to the whole macroeconomic framework of UK policy, much as happened in 1992, though for very different reasons. But that's an issue I put on one side. And the third element of recovery is reforming the banking system, as did not happen, for example, in Japan in the 1990s, when these bad debts stayed on banks' balance sheets. They weren't written down. They were so-called zombie loans. The bank managements that had caused this catastrophe stayed in place, and the economy didn't recover. There was a lost decade. Well, that's not happening in the Western economies, the advanced industrial economies, and the great financial crisis of 2007-2008. There does seem to be some concerted asset write-down to reflect the fact that these securitized mortgage loans and other asset-backed securities are possibly valueless. Certainly, there is no market for them at the moment. These three elements, monetary, fiscal, and banking overhaul, are the essential elements of a recovery from economic crisis. And so far as anyone can foresee truly volatile economic environment and the appalling outcome of some crashing policy mistakes, it does seem to be working. The problem, I think, for considering security is that there will be structural weaknesses that remain. There will be huge imbalances and structural flaws in the Western economies that will impinge upon the ability of the United States and its allies to defend themselves from the real existential threats, to be concerned with the risk that theocratic extremism will take root in failed states or encourage malign states to develop weapons of mass destruction. These are real constraints that I think will arise from the economic crisis brought on by a collapse in the Western financial system. Let me point to one or two. The weaknesses of the financial system will always be there in a market economy. There is always a risk of systemic financial collapse, if only because the banking system, the banks are tied together in the interbank lending market. If there is a problem of bad debts in one bank or one part of the financial system, then there is always a risk that the interbank lending market will freeze up. This will feed through into the real economy. Output will collapse. Unemployment will rise. This is pretty much a picture of exactly what has happened in the Western economies with terrible consequences. Some of that is, in principle, capable of being mitigated by better capital adequacy requirements for banks, making capital adequacy requirements countercyclical, that is, banks need to build up reserves in terms of expansion, rather as a consistent Keynesian would say that governments need to build up budget surpluses in times of expansion in order to have the room to borrow during a recession, as has not happened in the case of the UK. There is a degree to which the financial system can be repaired and reformed, but underlying the international financial system and global economy are massive structural imbalances that have built up over the last few years. And it's not difficult to see what they are. The United States, household savings in the United States have been drawn down because of, to some degree, because of an unsustainable asset price bubble, the housing price bubble. Households drew on their notional equity as a sort of ATM. They don't have savings. The level of savings, household savings in the UK has likewise been drawn down to critical levels. At the same time as this growth of indebtedness in the Western economies, and particularly in the English-speaking economies, a massive glut of savings has arisen in Asia, and specifically China. China looked at the Asian currency crisis of 97 and 98, and policymakers determined that in no circumstances would China be in a similar position under similar economic constraints imposed by the international financial system. There is a huge glut of savings in Asia. To a certain extent, that fueled the long boom in the Western economies. It allowed central banks to keep interest rates in the West below market clearing levels. It led to this massive explosion of credit. What's wrong with the Western economies is not just the effects of a housing bubble, but a credit bubble. Credit being the oxygen that the economy breathes. When it isn't there, tremendous economic dislocation takes place. Well, those imbalances will remain. And the only way to get around them is for the Chinese authorities to stimulate domestic demand rather than go for export-led growth, and for particularly the United States to repair those household balance sheets, to increase the level of domestic savings. And this is going to have an effect on the politics and economics and international position of the United States. It will direct attention to the growth in the international economy of sovereign wealth funds. Sovereign wealth funds are important. They are, by current estimates, they amount to around $2 trillion in the global economy. If you add another $6 trillion of foreign exchange reserves and another roughly $1 trillion of miscellaneous financial holdings of states such as Saudi Arabia, that's about 12% of cross-border assets that are directly under the control of sovereign authorities. They're under the control of governments. This overturns the notion of the international economy that became current after the collapse of communism. The international economy is no longer about, insofar as it ever was, about the free flow, the free exchange, the free trade across borders of individual agents and corporations. To a large extent, not a dominant extent, but to a large extent, the international economy now is dominated by flows under the control of governments. There is no evidence, and I'm very far from any sort of economic nationalist. I'm a passionate free trader. There is no evidence that these flows under the control of governments are being acquired for any sort of security interests. No evidence that strategic stakes in overseas industries are being built up. But it does pose two risks, I think. First, the countries themselves, the governments themselves that have built up these huge stocks, these huge stocks of savings, will misuse them in order to squander these economic gains for short-term political reasons. And there are examples, the Ecuador Sovereign Wealth Fund, the Nigerian Petroleum Trust, the two sovereign wealth funds in Venezuela, controlled by an obviously autarkic populist ruler, Mr. Chavez. There's a risk to these domestic economies, and there's a risk in the Western economies that the mere fact of these huge sums dominated by sovereign authorities will encourage economic and financial protectionism. We saw that in the United States with the Ports Authority, a perfectly reasonable deal whereby the Dubai Ports Authority would acquire economic holdings in the United States, provoked a tremendous political backlash. I very much fear that that's going to be the tenor of policy in many Western countries, specifically the United States.
Thank you very much. We've had